I was in a shop the other day, standing in a queue, and behind me, I heard a mother talking to her little girl. The little girl couldn't have been more than 2.5, just totting around, and the mother had dropped something and asked the little girl to help mummy by picking it up. And the little girl had a big smile on her face, and she totted over to the little thing that had fallen, and she picked it up, and she come back to the mother saying, "Help mummy, help mummy." It was just so cute and so beautiful. And then she turned around, and behind her in the queue was another little girl standing next to her mummy. And so she took a couple of steps towards this little girl and said, "Help mummy, help mummy." And I thought, that's just so beautiful, so cute. But this little other girl, she was having none of this. She quickly ducked in next to her mum's leg, grabbed her skirt and said, "No, my mummy." And I was like, okay, that's a bit intense, but anyhow. And the little girl looked, the first little girl looked a bit confused. And so she took another step and said, "Help mummy." And the little girl was like, "No, my mummy." And the little girl was just confused and took a couple more steps. And the girl went, "No, she is my mummy." And at this point, the second little girl's older sister comes over and she goes, "No, no, 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 no." And I thought, oh, the voice of reason finally. She put both her hands on her hips and said, "She is my mummy." I was like, what's going on here? Aside from being a little bit funny, the girls reminded me of just how easily kids become absorbed in their own world so that they assume that everything is about them. Another girl simply saying the word mummy means she must be trying to steal my mummy away from me. And little kids do this all the time. They generally live their lives thinking that the world revolves around them, that everything is theirs. This is why young kids have so much trouble on their sibling's birthday. Watching their sibling sit there with a big pile of presents as they unwrap one by one grates against them because someone else is getting the center of attention. Someone else is getting all the gifts. So grandparents often turn up to birthday parties with a spare gift for the other sibling just so that everything goes smoothly. But if we're honest, we adults are no different. We've just developed better filters for hiding these feelings, or we're just more socially aware of how ugly that attitude can look, so we suppress it. Sure, not all of us are egotistical maniacs, but deep down inside, we do tend to think that our life is ours, and we should be the primary beneficiary of everything that we do. We should have the capacity to treat ourselves with the money that we earn. We should be able to grab some me time whenever we feel we need it. We should strive to have the upper hand in our relationships so that we get what we want. Our school, our university degrees, our workplaces should exist to meet our needs. There was an ad on the radio a few years back about this lady who was looking to study. And she rang a university to see how flexible they would be and whether they would give her the study course she wanted. And they said, "No, we can't do that." And so she gets upset, calls another one who'll give her everything she wants. She can make the degree up herself. And I'm like, frustrating me so much because it's like the student knows more than the teaching institution. What? But that's how we think. We think everything should go our way and everything in our life exists for us. When we get something, whether we're gifted it or we earn it, our first assumption is that it is for us and we can do whatever we want with it. Like the little girls in the shop, our automatic assumption is that everything is about us. This is what makes Hannah's attitude in the first couple of chapters of 1 Samuel such a beautiful challenge to us. If you remember from last week, Hannah was the unfortunate victim of a nation that was a rudderless mess, of everyone just doing what was right in their own eyes. This is the epitome of this, everything is about me, I'm just going to do what I want, hang the consequences. On top of her grief of not being able to have any children, she suffered the indignity of being replaced by another woman. The humiliation of being ridiculed by this other woman and the loneliness of being misunderstood by her husband and the shame of being accused of drunkenness by the chief priest of the nation. Hannah's life was bathed in suffering, But instead of capitulating into darkness or raging with anger, Hannah casts herself upon Yahweh. Last week, we saw the beauty of her desperate faith. And this week, we're going to see the action that that faith produces and the truth Hannah has come to understand that empowers it. This morning, we're going to see what kind of life a desperate faith in Yahweh should produce and three stunning realities about our God that should give us the confidence to live it. Elkanah and his family had returned to Shiloh, where Hannah had made her desperate vow to God. And as we saw last week, she finally gave birth to a son, whom she named Samuel, which meant God hears. The story moves forward into verse 21 to the next annual trip to Shiloh for family worship. This time, Hannah tells her husband that she will stay home with her baby, who was probably only 2 or 3 months old at this stage, so that she might nurse the child to an appropriate age before she would honor her vow. Look at verse 22. As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Children in ancient Jewish society were probably weaned at about 3 years of age. So it's likely there were 2 more trips to Shiloh where Hannah would stay home. To this, Elkanah replied, "Do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word." In other words, you have made this vow to God. You follow your conscience before God. This phrase, "only may the Lord establish his word," is interesting because to this point, there has been no word of the Lord. God did not speak to Hannah while she prayed. There are no records of dreams or visions. Rather, it seems that Elkanah has taken God's miraculous provision of a son for Hannah as a sign that he is doing something amazing, that he's doing something bigger than just their family. And the short benediction he offers Hannah asks Yahweh to use these events for his purposes. May God establish his word through what is happening here. And this is vital because Elkanah, and as we're about to see, Hannah, both understand that while Samuel had been given to them, he was not gifted for their purposes, for their pleasure or prosperity. Samuel was a gift for God's purposes. You only have to look at Hannah's actions in verses 24 to 28 to see this. Once the boy no longer needs a mother to provide him with milk, she takes him straight up to Shiloh. She takes along sacrifices from their produce, a bull, flour, and wine, and they offer that sacrifice to the Lord. Then she presents Samuel to the priest Eli, saying in verse 26, "Oh my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who is standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord." Eli would have definitely remembered that he rebuked as a drunk, only to have to pull his head in and bless her. And now here she was, with the child who was an answer to both her prayers and his benediction to her we saw last week. Hannah's language here is telling. Our English translations can't fully capture the beauty of her declaration, but 4 times she uses a word that is derived from the same root meaning ask. The words granted, petition, and Lent all take their origin from the word ask. And if you remember from last week, Hannah named her boy God Hears because she asked for him from the Lord. Again, Hannah is driving home the reality that Samuel was God's gracious answer to her petition. And as such, now that she was no longer needed to nurse him as a mother, she was giving the one that she first asked for to the one that she asked for him from. Let us just take a moment to consider the gravity of Hannah's radical sacrifice here. She had spent year upon year praying for this child, suffering under the weight of childlessness. She had endured the taunts of Peninnah year after year. She had cast herself on the mercy of God, longing for a child. So intense was her prayer that Eli thought her to be a drunk. And now she finally had her child. And instead of centering her life on him, instead of turning her back on God to cling to her son, instead of simply doing what the overwhelming majority of people in her nation were doing, doing what was right in her own eyes, Hannah lent her child back to God. She takes her 3-year-old boy to the tabernacle in Shiloh and entrusts him into the service of Yahweh. Think about it. Like, it just reads simple in the text, but this is a mother who longed for a child, longed and longed for a child, and yet she willingly takes him and sacrificially gives him to the service of her God. This is Hannah's faith in action. She takes the son she prayed so long for, the son she suffered so long for, and she willingly and joyously gives him to the Lord. And the thing that struck me most about Hannah's radical act of sacrifice is her language exudes joy. She is eager to tell Eli that the prayer had been answered. Remember me? I'm that woman that was praying. She's excited to introduce him to the personification of that answer. For this child I prayed. And her joy is rooted in being a beneficiary of the grace of God. The Lord has granted me my petition. This is the kind of life that a desperate faith in Yahweh produces, a life of joyous and sacrificial dedication to that same God. And you know, there's so many parts of our lives where this action of our faith needs to be expressed. So many things that, as ones who claim to believe in Christ, we should be prepared to joyously sacrifice for His glory. Our finances, our careers, our possessions, our skills and ability, our time, and even like Hannah, our children. It's easy for us to be no better than the little girls in the shop, to assume everything is about us and everything that we have has been given to us for us. But God's gracious provision for us is never about promoting us. Everything we are given, we are supposed to hold lightly. Far too often we see our Christian faith as just an addition to our life, that we just fit Jesus into our life and he kind of acts like a rubber stamp to everything that we want to do. But the call to follow Christ is a call to surrender. Like Hannah, we're to see God's purposes as the main game of our lives, not our plans and dreams and desires. So when we're gifted or earn or win an unexpectedly large sum of money, we can't assume that it's all for us, that we spend it any way we wanted. We must be prepared to sacrifice it for God's purposes. When we retire from full-time work and suddenly we've got all this extra time on our hands, we cannot assume that this time exists simply for us to fulfill our bucket list, to do whatever we want in this time, to do the things we've always wanted to do. We must be prepared to sacrifice our time for God's purposes. And when we are gifted children by God, we cannot assume that these kids are ours to raise in order to fulfill our dreams for them, so that they become good reflections of us to achieve all the things that we couldn't. We must be prepared to sacrifice our hopes and dreams for our kids, for God's purposes for our kids. And I'm not talking about literally following Hannah and finding a monastery to leave your child at, but rather Rather than putting all of our energy and passion into raising our kids to meet our own expectations, put our passion and emotion and energy into connecting them with Jesus so that they might be captivated by him and follow him, regardless of whether it means they meet your dreams for them or not. What if your child decides, I'm going to pursue a life of poverty and mission in a country that desperately needs Jesus, and they never buy a house, they never have grandkids living next door to you that you can see whenever you want, they're on the other side of the world, none of your hopes and dreams for them come to be. But is it better that they fulfill God's purposes for their life? We need to be prepared to sacrifice the things that God gives us willingly and joyfully because his purposes far outweigh ours. When I see Hannah's willing and joyous service of Samuel, the child she spent her whole life longing for, and then I look at the trivial things that I hold onto far too tightly, I'm left wondering how Hannah could actually do this. Because it seems easy enough to say, let's sacrifice our things for God's purposes. That's an easy thing to say. It's easy maybe even to make vows like Hannah made. God, if you give me this, I'll do this for you. It's much harder to go through with it. And it's even harder to go through with it willingly and joyfully. How is Hannah able to do this? Where does her faith come from? Well, thankfully, Hannah does something next that gives us an answer. She sings. It's recorded as a prayer in the first 10 verses of chapter 2, but Hannah's words are so much more than that. They are a song. They are a psalm. They flow with rhythm and rhyme and poetic beauty. Like Adam bursting forth into song when he first sees Eve, like Moses and Miriam celebrating in song when they crossed the Red Sea, or Deborah rejoicing in song when Israel's enemy was defeated. Hannah's heart is so overwhelmed by the moment that her only response is to sing. And in this song, we find the secret to her courageous and beautiful faith. Listen to verse 1. My heart exalts in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. This is a vastly different tone to her prayer where she was pouring out her anxiety and vexation when she was in toil in the tabernacle last week. Now Hannah's prayer reveals a woman whose heart is bubbling over with praise for Yahweh. A woman whose horn, the center of her strength, has been lifted up by Yahweh. A woman who can confidently stand in the face of her enemies. A woman who is rejoicing in the salvation that she has received. Hannah's act of sacrifice is empowered by the fact she has personally encountered Yahweh. He is not an abstract idea to her or just the figurehead of her cultural belief system. Listen to the use of the personal language here. My heart, my horn, my mouth, I rejoice. These are not someone else's story. They are Hannah's story. She has encountered Yahweh in a personal way. And if we ever hope to find the kind of faith that leads to live a joyous and sacrificial life, we must encounter God personally. Some of you might be here today and happy enough to call yourself a Christian and go along with the general vibe of our congregation, but you have never made your faith personal. Perhaps for you, God is just simply a concept stuck on the pages of the Bible, not a real, living, and personal God. Surely you want more than that, something more than lip service. Surely you long for the beautiful relationship that Hannah has with her God. Well, stay tuned, because as Hannah continues to sing, she unpacks why being in relationship with this God has revolutionized her life. I was once driving along a road known to be a major thoroughfare for cyclists commuting into the city for work. And on this day, I was driving along on the side of the road, dressed in full cycling gear, one arm in a cast, was a man holding a big sign that said, "Did you see me get hit yesterday?" In front of him on the ground was a mangled bike frame. The thing that caught my eye as I drove past was the look on his face. It was a face that was torn between anger and desperation. Obviously, he'd been the victim of a hit and run, and he was desperately looking for someone who knew what happened. Someone who knew the truth. Someone who could speak up and bring justice for him. And if you've ever been the victim of some kind of injustice, you will know how this man felt. The world keeps on rolling like the cars driving past that man that morning, ignorant to the pain you have suffered and unaware of the truth. This was Hannah, suffering in silence, derided by Peninnah, misunderstood by her husband. But when she cast herself at the feet of Yahweh, she found somebody who knew about her plight. Listen to verses 2 and 3. "There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed." Yahweh is the one true God, evidenced by the fact that Yahweh is a God of knowledge. He knows. He's not blind to the plight of his people. Nothing escapes his watching eye. This makes him the weigher of all actions, the only just judge of all people. So Hannah warns people, people like Peninnah, that arrogance should be not found on their lips, because haughty and hurtful words are not missed by Yahweh. This means that Hannah knows she does not have to be branded with the vexatious taunts of Peninnah, or the shallow insecurity of her husband, or the ignorant accusations of Eli. None of their judgments mean anything. They carry no weight because they do not know her. They do not know her heart. They do not know her pain. But Yahweh does. Yahweh, he knows. And here we find the first stunning reality about our God that should fuel our lives of sacrificial and joyous surrender. Our God is the God of infinite knowledge. He is the God who knows. The fear of being mistreated or persecuted or simply cast out by others is a massive deterrent to the need to live a sacrificial life of following Jesus. The social and relational cost can be huge. So we will never embrace a life of sacrificial dedication to God as long as we consider him to be just like the other people who want to throw shade on us. People who know nothing about us or the hurts or the injustices that we have suffered. Only this stunning truth that God sees, that God hears, that God knows everything can give us the confidence to give ourselves to him. Whatever cost it is that you are being asked to give, whatever consequence comes of your surrender to God, God knows, he sees, he hears, he feels the hurt of his people. He is not a sovereign God who is distant and far away. He is a sovereign God who comes insanely close. He knows, he hears, he feels. Only this truth can empower us to give our lives to him. Hannah warns against haughty and hurtful words because there's no place for arrogance when one compares themselves to the God of infinite knowledge. Instead, Hannah would encourage us to embrace a humble vision of ourselves. And as she continues to sing, the beauty of this call for humility becomes more apparent. Listen to the language of verses 4 to 5. "The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength." Verse 5. "Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger." Verse 5 again, the barren has borne seven, but she who has many children is forlorn. Those who have exalted themselves because of their own measurements of
success, the mighty, the full, the fertile, God can bring low. And those who have been pushed aside by the world as being failures, the broken, the hungry, the barren,
God can raise up. In fact, Hannah seems to suggest that raising up the failures of this world is at the very core of who God is. Look at verse 8. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. Yes, verses 6 and 7 tell us of the sovereignty of God, that he is sovereign over life and death. He is sovereign over poverty and wealth. But the thrust of Hannah's song teaches us that God uses this sovereign power to raise up those who seem to be on the losing side of life. And this is the second stunning reality about the God that should fuel our lives of joyous sacrifice, is the truth that our God is the God who advocates for the humble and lowly. If sacrificing your career prospects leaves you scrambling to make ends meet, if sacrificing your reputation leaves you socially on the outer, if sacrificing your time leads to you missing opportunities, then you need to know that God not only sees it and knows it, but he reaches down into the lowliest state of those who have surrendered to him, and he raises them up. It's easy to look at the way the world works and think that the strong get stronger and the rich get richer and the popular get more popular. This can be a massive temptation to set our hearts on the upside of life, striving to win at all costs. But knowing that God's heart is bent towards the so-called losers of life liberates us to embrace a humble vision of ourselves, because regardless of whether we ever see it in this life or not, our God is all about lifting his people from the ash heap and giving them a seat of honor. Knowing this can fuel us to surrender and sacrifice our life and everything we have for Jesus, because even if we lose everything in this life, we have everything to gain from the God who raises us up from the ash heap. Finally, Hannah concludes her song with fighting words. Verse 9, he will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. We do not often like to think of God breaking his adversary to pieces or cutting off the wicked. It doesn't sit well with our modern sensibilities. It doesn't sit well with the image of a loving and caring and happy God. But Hannah equates this action of Yahweh as a salvation for his people. If you look carefully at her words here, Hannah has discovered a truth that often takes us far too long to learn. For not by might shall a man prevail. In our arrogance, we think we can succeed in this life in our own strength. That if we just look a bit deeper within, strive that little bit harder, or draw on the last little bit of strength, that we can be the heroes of our own story. Like every movie we have ever watched and every fairy tale we have ever had read to us, we think that we can be the hero, that we can dig deep and we can get ourselves through. But Hannah reminds us that we can never prevail by human strength, ingenuity, or goodness. We are destined to fail, for not by might shall a man prevail. So if even the best of humanity can't conjure up enough to prevail, imagine if you set yourself up in opposition to God. You don't stand a chance. The wicked will be cut off. His enemies will be broken to pieces. Only those who cast themselves upon Yahweh in faith will be saved. Their feet will be guarded. If Faith is not about being really strong and successful and then crediting it to God. It's all about resting all of your weight on God and allowing Him to show us how strong He is. This is life. We think and we teach and we raise kids to understand this truth, that as you grow, you get smarter, you get stronger, you get better, you get wiser. You figure out how to be a better person in this world and succeed better in this world. But when things of faith are brought into it, we need to understand that life is not about figuring out how strong you can be. Faith is all about figuring out how weak you are and how strong God is. Every time you rest your weight on God and He comes through and He guards your feet and He holds you safe, you figure out God is strong enough for that. God is strong enough for this. And every time it's like a muscle growing, this picture of God being strong enough to take whatever trial you have been through. This is faith. And knowing this empowers our capacity to sacrifice. The third stunning reality about God that should fuel our lives of joyous sacrifice is the truth that our God is the God who is faithful in salvation. He will guard the feet of those who trust themselves to Him by faith, not those who try to prevail in their own strength. We can recognize our weakness, admit our weakness, and throw ourselves on the mercy of God because He is strong enough for all of us. Hannah's song reveals how she was able to willingly and joyfully sacrifice her beloved and long prayed for son to Yahweh's purposes. And it's not because Hannah is special. It's not because she's some crazy woman who's just reckless and throwing her son away. It's not because she is some super believer. It's simply because she has had a personal experience of just how amazing Yahweh was. Yahweh was the God of all knowledge. He saw the injustices she suffered. He knew her lot. Yahweh was the God who advocates for the humble. He would be her strength. Yahweh was the God who was faithful in salvation. He would guard her feet. Hannah's song points to the fact that she has seen Yahweh and recognized His ultimate faithfulness. Yahweh is the ultimately faithful God who would be faithful to His people, who would be faithful to her, who would be faithful to Samuel, faithful through Samuel to the nation. And so she willingly hands her son to God's purposes. Hannah finishes her song with a statement that should raise questions in our minds. Verse 10, the Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to His king and exalt the horn of His anointed. He will give strength to His king. He will exalt the horn of His anointed. Who was Hannah speaking about here? Because we found out last week there was no king in Israel. There was no anointed one. Rather than having a specific person in mind, in the power of the Spirit, Hannah is filled with confidence that Yahweh would provide the nation with the leadership they needed. She knew the every man for himself situation was wrong. It wasn't working. It was leading the nation away from God. And she knew that the leaders they did had, like Eli and his sons, were failing miserably. And by faith, she envisages an anointed king that God would raise up for them. And in doing so, she stands in a line of faithful women who sing of the God who used their humble estate to raise up salvation for the people. A line that continues with another young mother who sings. In Luke chapter 1, Mary, the mother of Jesus, sings a song that is crazy similar to Hannah's song. It is so similar. Take some time today, go to Luke chapter 1 and read her song and just see the similarities. The song of a woman who had personally experienced the just, merciful, and gracious work of Yahweh to raise up salvation for the whole world. But the child that she sung about, Mary, was the king that Hannah foresaw, the anointed one that she anticipated by faith, Jesus Christ. The Hebrew word for anointed is Messiah, which translates into Greek as Christ. Hannah foresaw through the power of the Spirit that God would be raising up a king, raising up in strength and faithfulness an anointed king, a Messiah. And when we think of Jesus, when we think of what God has done for us in Jesus, that like Hannah, only in an infinitely more powerful way, God sacrificed his son. God gave his son over to his purposes, over to this world that would mistreat him, over to this world that would reject him, over to this world that would kill him. And Jesus willingly submitted himself to his Father's plan. Jesus willingly and joyously looked for the joy that was set before him and endured the cross, sacrificing his very life for us. When we think about what God might be calling us to give up by trusting in him, the life of sacrifice and faith that he is calling us to live, we need to see something about God that gives us confidence to do that. We need to see that he will not let us down, that he will reach down and scoop up us up out of the ash heap if that is where we end up, that he will hear and know of our plight, that he will be the strong salvation that will guard our feet. And nothing teaches us that more than the fact that God himself was prepared to sacrifice his only son for our joy, for our hope, for our salvation. Seeing God do this through Jesus should give us the confidence to sacrifice whatever we have in this life for his sake and for his purposes. Because ultimately one day we would stand before that Jesus and we will receive that ash heap to the place of princes. We will receive that from our Jesus. And it's in confidence in Jesus that we can have the faith to surrender our lives. Let's pray together.